I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:37 PM on Wednesday, April 26th, 2023. And present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Representative Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne, myself, Co-Chair Foster, and Representative Galvin. And also, reminder, if folks can mute their cell phones, and that's this afternoon, we'll hear our two final confirmations. Then the Department of Health will speak to the changes made to SB 57, that is the Medicaid Assistance for Adult Home Care. And then we'll hear, we'll set that bill aside. And after that, we'll hear SB 58, which is Medicaid eligibility for postpartum mothers. We'll take amendments and then hopefully move the bill from committee today, if that is the will of the committee. And then finally, we'll hear the introduction for House Bill 28, that's access to marijuana conviction records by Representative Wright. So, first up are the governor's appointments to boards and commissions. And we'll start with Brett Huber, commissioner designee for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And we'll hear from the commissioner designee, and then we'll take time for questions. So with that, Mr. Huber, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. If you can put yourself on the record, and if you've got anything to present, and then we'll go to questions.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chairs Edgman and Johnson, and members of the House Finance Committee, I'd like to begin by thanking the committee for their time and attention this afternoon. For the record, my name is Brett Warner Huber Sr., and I'm pleased to join the committee today for your review and consideration of my appointment as Commissioner and Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. By way of a brief personal background, I was born in South Dakota. My family moved to Colorado, where I graduated high school and attended some college before moving to Alaska in 1984 with my wife and baby daughter. Like many, we hit the road north seeking our future and the amazing outdoor recreational opportunities in Alaska. I can tell you that Alaska felt like home as soon as we crossed the border. I'm a father of three, blessed to have been a stepdad to four, and even more blessed by the many grandchildren in my life. I'm an avid outdoorsman, hunting, fishing, biking, hiking, camping, you name it. This state's been very good to me personally and professionally, and I've had a deep love for Alaska and her people. One of my first jobs in Alaska was the Anchorage branch manager of Alaska Tent and Tarp, where among my duties were the design and installation of geomembranes and geotextiles, pit liners, on the North Slope as well as on the Kenai Peninsula. This on-the-pad, in-the-field contract work, while limited, provided me my first actual close-up exposure to the industry here. It was big, busy, highly organized, carefully maintained, and closely regulated. The lion's share of my experience, however, and my experience with and my understanding of the oil and gas industry came through my work right there in the Capitol building and in the course of my interim duties. I've been fortunate to be involved in the public policy arena since 1994 when I became a legislative staffer. In each legislative office in which I served, resources and specifically oil and gas policy was in my portfolio, including staffing the Senate Resource Committee for Senator Halford in the late 1990s. In addition to the understanding that I gained through my legislative duties, I advantaged myself of opportunities to participate in legislative familiarization trips to the North Slope, as well as the many training sessions and conferences relating to the industry sponsored by groups such as AOGA, RDC, and the Alliance. Between my two spans of service to the legislature, I ran a statewide nonprofit and was appointed to the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council's Public Advisory Committee, where I became the chairman. Serving in this role, and then following as EVO's program coordinator for the Department of Fish and Game, provided me an important opportunity to gain another perspective of the industry. Following my second tour as legislative staff and his successful 2018 campaign, Governor Dunleavy asked me to serve as his senior policy advisor, where once again, oil and gas were an important component of my portfolio. This position allowed me to deepen my knowledge of Alaska's oil industry, as well as a chance to learn from and work cooperatively with my oil and gas policy colleagues in other states. I first became aware of the work of the AOGCC in the early 1990s with the unitization of Prudhoe Bay. I followed it intermittently over the years when the legislature had interest in AOGCC action warranted. And I followed the commission's work again closely as they deliberated and set a new gas offtake rate for the North Slope. I also had the advantage of meeting nearly every year with former AOGCC commissioners Forrester and Seamount as they made their visit to the legislature, and then working with them even more closely as we consulted on IOGCC issues while I was in the governor's office. What I learned from them intrigued me very much about the commission's work and service to the public. I'm very happy to have both of them support my appointment. When the governor asked me to serve on the commission, I was both humbled and instantly excited for the opportunity. As you know, the AOGCC has an extremely important role in our state as the independent, quasi-judicial agency tasked with regulating the oil and gas industry in Alaska. In my estimation, I've joined an agency with a long history of doing good and important work that is fully funded by the industry we regulate, that has a knowledgeable and dedicated staff, and an excellent and highly experienced fellow commissioners who occupy the dedicated geologist and engineer seats. And perhaps most importantly, a mature and clear statutory underpinning for the work we do. My first day on the job was January 9th, a little over a month, 3.5 months ago. I can tell you that while I've learned a bit about the technical downhole side of the business, there is much more to learn, and I plan to do that. That said, I realize I'm not an engineer or geologist, but I do consider myself a reasonably quick study, and frankly, the commission has those fields well covered with Commissioners Chmielewski and Wilson. I believe as the public member, my responsibilities include asking a ton of questions, doing my homework, approaching issues fairly and impartially, listening carefully to our staff, to my fellow commissioners, and to the public, and then making sound and fair decisions on the merits of the issues presented while adhering to the statutory and regulatory guidance upon which our work is grounded. In addition, I'm responsible for the administrative management of our agency and serve as lead in communication and participation with the legislature. I'm sorry I'm not there in person today, but I will be joining you for your hearing on House Bill 50 on Friday. Again, I can share with you that I'm excited to serve Alaska in this capacity. I get up every day ready to go to work, and I've jumped in with both feet. I like new challenges, and I love to learn. Should the committee see fit to forward my nomination and the legislature confirm my appointment, I pledge my continued hard work, commitment, and a willingness to listen, learn, and lead to the best of my ability in the service of the people of Alaska and with an eye toward our future generations. Mr. Chairman, before I conclude my testimony, I'd like to clarify that the resume submitted is not a complete history of my employment, but instead the positions most relevant to this appointment. In addition, although not reflected on the resume, I left service in the governor's office briefly in 2020 and again in 2022 to participate in statewide campaigns. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and committee members for the opportunity to be with you today via teleconference and provide my statement. I'm happy to address any questions at your convenience, sir.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Huber. You mentioned that your resume was more applicable, the items listed to the position that you're being appointed to, and so there are some maybe some gaps possibly, and one of them I noticed was just Alaska Tent and Tarp from 1984 to 1986, and then the next position listed here is Chief of Staff, Alaska State Senate from 1994 to 1999, and I was just wondering if you could maybe comment on that period from 1986 to 1994?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, to the best of my recollection, I can tell you that I've had a number of positions and jobs at different opportunities in Alaska, but following work at Alaska Tent and Tarp, I actually moved to King Salmon, Alaska, where I began a small sport fishing and outfitted hunting operation. I was out there for about a year and a half, then returned to Fairbanks. When I returned to Fairbanks, I actually went to work for KQRP radio station, selling radio advertising, and then advanced to their salesman. During that time, my wife and I added another child. To do that, we actually moved back to Minnesota for the time being near my folks. Well, we got ready for the baby, and the baby was born. Then I came back to Alaska as soon as the baby was born. Renee and Benjamin, a few weeks old, joined me on the Talkeetna River, where I was chief guide for Mahay's Riverboat Service and managed his lodge until 1994, when I then left that position to go to work for the legislature. then the gap that you see in 2005 through 2012 could be the most easily answered in one word, and that's Maui. So at that point in time in my life, I was not ready yet to retire, nor could I. But I did have some things I wanted to do on a beach. So we moved to Maui in 2005, not knowing how long we'd stay. It turned out to be 7 years. During that time, I became a master scuba instructor and taught scuba. I did 1,000 dives the first year I was in Maui. I ran a dive boat, and I managed a gym. I then came back in 2012, served, and went back to work for the legislature. I hope that helps.
Great. Thank you very much. And I think my favorite might be the 2005 to 2012. So thank you. Maui sounds great. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Hannon, then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Huber, as you well know, this is not, like many of our boards and commission appointments, this is not a volunteer gig. This is a highly paid job, where our expectation is that you are the eyes and ears to make sure that Alaska's oil and gas industry comply with all of our law and leases, et cetera. And there are three seats on the board, a geologist, an engineer, and as you've said, that you're the public member. And you've had some in and outs working in directly in elected politics, and I want to just hear from you how you can affirm for us that you will have the eyes and ears of our legal obligations as the public oversight board there, not as a political appointee, because you've had a mixed history in that, and since I don't see an academic background in this area, and you are the public member, I just want to hear it from you on the record.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannon, thank you for the question. You're exactly right. We have the regulatory obligation to oversee the oil and gas industry in Alaska. For the most part, it's the underground portion, although we're also involved with the inspection and with the metering. Both the leasing activity is handled by DNR. But this is a purely regulatory role, which leaves no room for politics. It leaves room to actually, again, rely on the very clear and concise statutory and regulatory direction. It puts me in a position to rely on my fellow commissioners and the staff and the precedents that's been set by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission over time. But I do understand completely that I have served in political roles in the past, I have served in policy roles in the past, and I've served in the private sector in the past. I clearly understand that this is a regulatory function, not a political position, and I do understand that it is a good job, a well-paying job, and a very busy job with lots of detail, lots of homework, and lots of work to be done, and I believe I'm up to the task. Thank you again for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Huber, your duties, you know, you've been at this job as the commissioner designee and chairman designee since January. And because, you know, I live in southern southeast Alaska and the oil and gas industry is not immediately around me. We have some people that, you know, go up to the North Slope and work for industry, but, you know, they, of course, go back and forth. So tell me, what are the day-to-day duties for the commissioner chairman of the AOGCC? What do you often, how do you spend day-to-day? Is it vary quite a bit, or what are your main tasks when you go about your day-to-day business in that particular role?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ortiz, thank you for that question. It is quite varied, but quite busy. For example, today I worked on notice of information requests on a potential issue. I don't want to get into the details, but a potential issue with an operator on the slope. I attended our engineering and geologist check-in meeting that we hold every Tuesday and Thursday morning to make sure that the staff and the commissioners are on the same page and up to date on the work in front of us. I approved, along with my fellow commissioners, after staff review, 2 permits to drill and 5 sundry applications. We are the agency that's in charge of oil wells from cradle to grave, if you will, both permitting how the drilling program begins and then any changes to the program, all the way up to plug and abandonment. So approving and researching and talking with staff about sundries and permits is a piece of the day. Yesterday, we had several meetings with industry folks that are currently involved in the industry and others that have an interest or opportunity or gaining additional information. So it's divide, and then quite frankly, this session with House Bill 50, the CCUS bill, and House Bill 74, the geothermal bill, the AOGCC has been a lot more involved in legislative actions than it is in normal years. So that has been something that I have some experience in, so I've taken that role chiefly, which is also depending on the day and how the legislative process is moving is a portion of the work I do as well. I hope that answers your question, sir.
It does. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? I believe we have somebody online who would like to testify. Ms. Aubrey Weber, are you online?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, Mr. Aubrey Weber, if you can state your name and your affiliation and provide your comments.
Hi. Aubrey Weber, I'm the Executive Director of the 907 Initiative, and I'm calling today to testify in opposition of this appointment. The commission is an entity whose mission explicitly requires protection of the public interest. And as was stated before, Mr. Huber has a long history working in politics and has deep ties to Governor Dunleavy. Alaskans need someone who will rise above politics to represent the public interest, and I'm concerned Mr. Huber will not do that. Additionally, Mr. Huber's professional record includes dishonest statements to the Alaska Public Offices Commission under oath. For these reasons, I ask that you do not confirm Mr. Huber to the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Does the committee have any questions, Mr. Weber? Seeing none, any further questions for Mr. Huber? Seeing none, Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, if it's Mr. Weber.
Mr. Weber, W-I-E-B-E-R.
Mr. Weber, my question for you is, are you a primary source of information on your comments or a secondary source of information?
Secondary.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Huber, do you have any closing comments?
No, again, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to join you telephonically today. And I'm looking forward to being in town on Friday for that hearing. If I would offer, if any of the members wish to meet with me individually, I'm happy to make myself available. I plan on flying in on the morning flight and out on the evening flight, and I appreciate the committee's time today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Huber. If it is the will of the committee, I would entertain a motion.
Co-Chair Foster.
Representative Co-Chair Johnson.
The House Finance Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration: Brett Huber, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. This does not reflect an intention by any member to vote for or against this individual during further session for purpose of confirmation.
Thank you very much. We have a motion for us. Is there an objection? If there is no objection, we will take a brief. It is to sign the paperwork. So what this means is the name will be advanced to the floor for a full floor vote. So there will be continuing discussion on this nominee. So with that, we'll take a brief. It is to sign the paperwork. And House Finance, back on record. Next is the governor's appointment of Robert Doyle, a commissioner designee for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And we'll hear from the commissioner designee, and then we'll take questions from both the committee and if there's anybody online, which I don't see anybody right now. So with that, Mr. Doyle, if you can put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, my name is Robert Doyle, and after graduating from East Anchorage High School, I attended the University of Oregon. Subsequent to graduating from there, I went to Alaska Schools and worked there for the last 31 years. I worked my first few years in Anchorage, a couple years in Sitka, and then 25 years in Mat-Su. The last 5 years in Mat-Su, I was the superintendent of schools. And after, and I did that after I got my master's degree from the University of Alaska Anchorage. Anyway, I retired in 2007 and did various community service projects, Wasilla Food Pantry, and got them organized so that they could apply for grants and get some staff and get a little bit more organized. And after about 3 years of doing that, I went on to the Matanuska Electric Board of Directors, was elected to serve, and the last 2 years, I spent 12 years there, and the last 2 years I was president of the board. Last year when I was asked to serve on the RCA, I resigned my position at MEA. During the last 11 months anyway, I've worked on many dockets as a part of an outstanding team of five commissioners and staff. And in terms of the work that we do here, we work on making sure that the Alaska electrical grid and energy sources are reliable, affordable, safe. We work on the public interest of all our ratepayers by assessing the capabilities of utilities and pipeline companies. We make sure that our decisions are based on a clear public record and due process while keeping the ratepayers first and foremost in our minds. And to remind me of that, I've got a note up on my board up here to make sure that we answer the question, is it good for all ratepayers? And that's one of the focuses that we take. We evaluate applications to become utilities to determine if the companies are fit, able, and willing to provide technical, managerial, and financial support. We conduct financial reviews for the PCE program. We work with all utilities, some of which that needed some assistance, like the Mid-Kuskokwim Electrical Cooperative we recently worked with to make sure that the ratepayers are being well served. Public regulations can help prevent a lot of unnecessary duplication of service, inefficient use of energy resources, stranded investments, and unfair practices. One of the things that we did after the legislature passed the law enabling that, we have a ERO, Electrical Reliability Organization, was called now, I think it's the RRC, and it's providing and up and standing this year. Will be the budget's been approved by the RCA, and they'll be working on grid efficiency, availability, and affordability. Anyway, Alaskans require robust and secure sources of generation that will keep their lights and heat on for their families' homes all through the winter. And in the summer, energy security is first and foremost in their minds, and as such, that's one of our big priorities. I accepted this opportunity for community service, came out of retirement. I appreciate the consideration of the legislature, and I'm willing to answer any questions you may have.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Doyle. Do we have any questions of the committee? Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doyle, have you read the statute about the requirements to serve as a commissioner for the RCA?
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, the statute 4204.020 says to qualify for appointment as a commissioner, the person must be a member in good standing of the Alaska Bar Association or have a degree in an accredited university with a major in engineering, finance, economics, accounting, business admin, or public administration. It then goes on to say experience of 5 years in the practice of those fields could substitute. Mr. Doyle, it appears by the limited resume you shared with me or shared with the committee that you don't qualify. Can you explain on the record why you believe you are qualified under the statutory requirements to serve on the board?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for that question and through the chair. As the master's degree program from the University of Alaska that enables you to become a superintendent, it's in educational administration. During my 25 years in Mat-Su, I started in business administration, running the HR department for probably 7 years, running the entire finance department and operations as the chief operating officer for all of the finance and business section for the entire school district. At the time, I believe that our business functions at the Mat-Su School District being the second largest in the state. I think we had 1,800 employees, 16,000 students, and $183 million budget. We were able to do that, and at a certain point in time when the school district needed help, if the district was really good for our family, raising our children in Mat-Su, the school board asked me if I would be willing to become superintendent. I said yes. That wasn't one of my goals, but I was willing to give back to the administration and do that for 5 years. Every one of those years, we met our board goals for student achievement and learning. We met all of our adequate yearly progress. We reduced achievement gaps between racial groups. And I'm proud of the investment in time, both in the University of Alaska Anchorage for the educational degree and the opportunity to use that degree in administration. So I believe that that would qualify as public administration.
Thank you, Chair Foster.
Thank you. And maybe if I could dovetail off of Representative Hannon's comments, just in terms of some detail. Mr. Doyle, I wonder if maybe, and I think in your testimony you provided some of the answers, if either you could submit your testimony in writing, or if we could just get a little more detail on your resume, including like what years you're with Matanuska Electric Association and so forth, just to give sense on the floor, once we go to the floor for a floor vote, a little better sense of your experience.
Sure.
Great, thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, as a follow-up to Representative Hannon's line of questioning, Mr. Doyle, what is the, and you might have stated this in passing, what's the primary responsibility of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska? And as such, how do your skills and abilities are going to be able to contribute to fulfilling that primary responsibility of the Regulatory Commission?
Okay, through the chair, without talking about any specific docket that we have open at this time, basically we would, as a team, as a leadership piece, there's five commissioners. The chair is picked among them to kind of organize and be overall all five, and the staff, and you're assigned particular dockets with staff and administrative law judges who will prepare for a hearing. For example, if you have a company or somebody that wishes to become a utility, they would apply for certification. The statute would talk about that, you know, what we have to look for. We have to determine that they're fit, able, and willing to provide the technical and managerial and financial support that's required of a public utility, meeting the definition of what a public utility is. And in the statute, there's, you know, they have to serve at least a minimum of 10 customers, or they have to be taking over for a utility that's pulling out of that area, or they have to be doing wholesale power. So, I mean, there's some statutory definitions that must be met. There's some regulatory definitions must be met. We then, once we get the opportunity, work with the parties, whether there's an opposition or not. We process through that in a hearing. We get all that information on the record. Eventually, we make a determination of it, if it's whether it's a public interest or not, to grant that certificate. And that's in general one docket, but we're over pipelines as well as utilities, refuse service, water, gas, and electricity.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Doyle. We got a question from Representative Galvin.
Oh, thank you, Chair Foster. Thank you so much, Mr. Doyle. I did hear you say early on in your introduction that energy security is first in mind, and I really appreciate that. And I wondered if you might share how your leadership might uniquely fit Alaskans' needs right now. We're just hearing so much about this, and would love to hear what you might uniquely bring to this leadership position.
Well, one of the things that, thank you to the chair, one of the things that I think that we need to have is basically all hands on deck, all options on the table. I think we need to take a look at new things that we haven't been doing. We have to be as diverse as we possibly can, but at the same time, under the statute, we need to make sure that it's affordable, needs to be reliable. People expect when you turn that switch on that the power comes on and that the pilot light lights. I think that it's important for us to realize how important that is in Alaska, in particular with long, cold, dark winters. It's not the same as if you're in Hawaii and you don't have heat. You know, in Alaska, it could be a life and death situation. So I think some of the things that we did when we were at MEA for 10 years, well, actually 12, because the last 2 years I served as the board president, we started the first large wholesale through an IPP of solar project up at Willow. In addition to that, we're expanding that into the Meadow Lakes area. I think that we need to take a look at that. We need to take a look at wind. We've got a hydro. At the time, MEA was about 20% with Eklutna Hydro and with Bradley Lake Hydro. We need to take a look at that. We need to take a look at wind energy. I really think that everything's on the table, and one of the things I don't think people think enough of is on the demand side. I think people really need to take a look at conservation, and natural gas is not going to just disappear in the next 5 years. It's not going to go to zero. I think the questions are, can the contracts that have been negotiated with all utilities be renegotiated? How much will there be, and can they be guaranteed at the same level or greater levels than we have now? So I really think demand side issues are things that we're going to have to look at. As a part of that, there's an upcoming May Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference. I think we need to participate in that. We need to get the information out to people on both sides of the issues, pros and cons of the different alternatives, lay all the alternatives on the table, and then do what's best in the public interest for our ratepayers. So that's, in terms of my bringing to the table, I think I bring an open mind to the table, and I think I bring a lot of team leadership to the table where I can work within teams. I can work with very diverse groups of people, different opinions, where people can sit down and hear both sides of the issue and come up with what we think is going to be the best for the long-term future of our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So with that, I would entertain a motion. Representative Co-Chair Johnson.
Certainly. It is my privilege to make this motion, Co-Chair Foster. The House Finance Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and moves that the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. Robert Doyle, a commissioner for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. This does not reflect an intention by any member to vote for or against this individual during any further session for the purpose of confirmation.
Okay, hearing no objection, Mr. Doyle's name will be forwarded to be considered during the joint session. We'll have paperwork to sign if everyone can do that. We do have three bills before us today, and we do have a hard stop at 3 o'clock for a meeting with the Senate. So if we can't get to the third bill, which is the access to marijuana conviction records, I'm hoping maybe we could have a short introduction, and then we can hear it as bills previously heard at another meeting, preferably this week. So with that, we'll move over to Senate Bill 57, which is the Senate version of House Bill 58. So that's the Medicaid Assistance for Adult Home Care. And this bill was changed in the other body. So we'll have the department come up and explain the changes and answer any questions to the new bill. So I'd like to ask Mr. Tony Newman, Division of Senior and Disabilities Services Director, to come to the table, place yourself on the record, and walk us through Senate Bill 57 and the changes. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. My name is Tony Newman, and I'm the Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services at the Alaska Department of Health. Thank you, Chair Foster and members of the committee, for hearing the Governor Senate Bill 57. As you indicated, I was with you last week to discuss House Bill 58, and I am back before you again to give you a quick overview of the version of the bill that was just transmitted from the other body and answer any questions you may have. The most significant difference between the adult home care bill that we reviewed last week and this version of the bill is that Senate Bill 57 has new language that would allow certain family members and others who have a legal duty to support an individual to be allowed to be paid to provide personal care services to that individual under one of our Medicaid programs. This program is called the Community First Choice Program. It's authorized under a subsection of the Federal Social Security Act known as the 1915K option. Right now, under Medicaid, under department regulations, certain family members, spouses, parents of minor children, and other people, such as adult children of parents who've been assigned guardianship, are prohibited from being paid to provide Medicaid-funded personal care or home and community-based waiver services unless a court order allows it. This was a prohibition that we lifted under the public health emergency out of concern that people would not be able to find caregivers during the pandemic. The workforce shortages that have been seen throughout the entire service and health care sectors have been especially acute for providers of home and community-based services. But the experience we gained offering this flexibility, as well as the findings from a provider survey that we did, conversations with our stakeholders, and national experience have all suggested that with the proper safeguards, we can allow this change to continue on a permanent basis. So this bill would allow a limited subset of those people receiving Medicaid-funded personal care to have, say, a spouse or a guardian be paid to help them with their bathing or feeding or other activities of daily living. If this bill passes and is signed by the governor, we will write regulations that will enable us to make sure this is done in a manner that helps ensure the safety and well-being of individuals receiving care this way. I should emphasize that while both the original adult home care aspects of the bill and the additional new pieces around legally responsible individuals providing care will both be administered by the Division of Senior Disability Services, but the bills do not directly affect each other otherwise. That is, adult home care will be a waiver service, not a 1915K service. Therefore, legally responsible individuals wouldn't provide adult home care to someone in their care. More details around that will have to be worked out, and as I say, we intend to do that through a careful regulatory development process that includes input from our stakeholders. With that, Chair Foster, I'll pause and take questions. And I also wanted to say I understand Alexis Rodich, who represents the Service Employees International Union, I believe is on the line. Ms. Rodich was closely involved with the sponsors of SB 106 and HB 127 and development of those bills, and she may also be able to answer questions or want to comment.
Great. Thank you very much. Ms. Rodich is not available right now, what I can tell. Correct? Yep. But maybe in Alexis will be online possibly later, and I'll let you know if I see that pop up. I do have two quick questions. The first, so this is a bill was rolled into this bill, correct? Which bill was that? Which Senate version or which Senate bill was rolled into?
Chair Foster, it was Senate Bill 106.
106, okay, thank you. And then the other question I've got is, it doesn't look like there are any additional fiscal notes, so what we've got before us hasn't changed in terms of the fiscal notes, correct?
Correct, Chair Foster. I believe we've either already or we've prepared to the new fiscal notes to reflect the new narrative, but there's no change to the amounts in them.
Great, thank you. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Newman, could you, toward the end of your statement, you said something about how this won't be a 1915K, it'll be a regular waiver or something. I'm not sure what you said. Can you repeat that?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the original adult home care bill that we brought before you last week that premiered as Senate Bill 57 and House Bill 58 is referring to a Medicaid waiver service. Adult home care will be a Medicaid waiver service. The allowance for legally responsible individuals to provide personal care that has been added to the bill is not a waiver service. It's what's called a Community First Choice 1915K program service.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, can you quickly, you have used the term legally responsible individuals. Can you put a definition on legally responsible individuals, please?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. Under Alaska regulations, we refer to individuals who have a legal duty to support another individual. And by our regulations, that refers to a a spouse of a recipient of services. It refers to the minor child of a parent. And it also refers to an individual with a legal duty to support the recipient under state law, which is interpreted to mean a guardian. So a guardian who's been assigned by the court to an individual. So those are the three under this regulation that we would need to amend, the three types of individuals we would want to care for. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions on the bill? I see no questions. So with that, thank you, Director Newman. And at this time, I'm going to set an amendment deadline for this bill for Friday at 5 p.m., April 28th. And if you can either drop off or email to my staff, Brody Anderson, your amendments. So Representative Josephson?
Actually, if I could.
Mr. Newman?
Through the chair, Mr. Newman, is the reason why the fiscal note is so, in my view, small, because the introduction of SB 106 into this is mostly going to be borne by the federal government? How is it that I like the bill. I still like the bill. My curiosity is how does the state pay these people who haven't been paid before? If I'm looking, unless there's more fiscal notes coming.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it's a good question. Why wouldn't there be, if we're allowing more people to be able to provide services, why wouldn't there be an increase in the Medicaid services billed to the state? And there's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is that this is going to represent a very small number of people. Right now, the Community First Choice Program, the 1915K option, serves around 850 people. A small subset of those individuals will be seeking to have a legal responsible individual provide care for them. Another reason is that we are tending to see a slow bleed of providers of home and community-based services in the state. We've seen a decrease in the number of people we've been able to serve because of the loss of providers. I don't believe this bill will increase the pool of providers so much as it will stop the bleed of providers that we're seeing in the home and community-based service sector, if that makes sense. And we have been offering this service under the we've been offering this flexibility under the pandemic, and we have not witnessed an increase in costs. So we are going to be, through this bill, we're going to be maintaining that flexibility for a small subset of the people who are allowed to receive a legally responsible individual's care who've been allowed under the pandemic. Once the bill passes and the regulations are written, there'll be a small subset of people who'll be able to continue that flexibility.
Follow up?
So the slow bleed you referred to just means that other non-familial people used to get paid for a service. They've left, some of them, and now familial connections will get reimbursed for their good efforts. Is that the essence of what you...
Through the chair, that's a good summation.
Thank you.
I'd like to note that Representative Edgman is also with us, and then I want to also say that Alexis Rodich is online. I do have a question from Representative Colon, but Mr. Newman, I don't know if you wanted Alexis Rodich to be available for questions, or was there a statement that you had that this person was going to make?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, Ms. Rodich worked closely with the sponsors in the development of Senate Bill 106 as well as HB 127, and she may have a comment or also available to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to her in a moment. Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. Mr. Newman, I just wanted a clarification. So with this amendment with the legally responsible, and I know you mentioned guardians, I just want to be sure, does that cover foster parents, and does that cover adults taking care of their elderly parents?
Through the chair, Representative Colum, regarding the second category you mentioned, adult children taking care of their parents, mm-hmm. if those adult children are assigned guardianship of the parent, it would apply to them. They would be allowed under this provision. Currently, they would be allowed right now if they're not assigned guardianship because they're not guardians. Right. That's not a prohibition that's in place currently.
Okay.
And as far as foster, that's an interesting question around foster parents. Under the regulation, and I'm reading it right now, it's 7 AAC 127.015, a foster parent is not considered an individual with a legal duty to support a recipient. So that would remain unchanged.
Okay, can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So I thought, maybe I misunderstood, I thought this was trying to fix foster children that were going through, that were disabled and going up through adulthood. I thought that was trying to help that situation.
Through the chair, Representative Collum, that's a good observation. The original bill, adult home care, was designed to provide a service, better service to children aging out of foster care. The two bills are not connected in that way. That is, as I mentioned, the legally responsible individual portions of the bill would not be related to the adult foster care portions of the bill. The two would be both administered by our division, but they are not connected directly in that they're two different services.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Rodich, can you put yourself on the record, state your name, your affiliation, and if you've got any statements you want to make, feel free to do so. Otherwise, if you're just here for questions, we're fine with that, too.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Alexis Rodich. I am with SEIU 775, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. I don't see any questions from the committee. So with that, as I mentioned, the amendment deadline for SB 57 will be this Friday at 5 p.m., April 28th, and please drop them off at our office or email them to Brody Anderson. Thank you very much, Mr. Newman. So with that, so we'll set this bill aside, and we'll move over next to Senate Bill 58. That is the Medicaid eligibility for postpartum mothers. And so with that, I'd like to ask Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer, and Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie, to come to the table. I think Ms. Zink is online. And Ms. Zink, if you can put yourself on the record. Ms. Ritchie, maybe she's supposed to be in the room, but not.
For the record, Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. Dr. Ann Zink is actually downstairs in Senate Judiciary right now and will join us as soon as she's able to do that.
Okay, if you can put yourself on the record, and I don't know if you're willing and able to fill in for Dr. Zink.
For the record, my name is Emily Ricci. I'm Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Health, and I'm available to the committee as needed today.
Okay, thank you. Maybe can you give us a quick summary, just to freshen everybody's memories on this one?
Sure, through the chair. SB 58 will extend Medicaid coverage for postpartum for women following for women in the postpartum period from its current coverage extension of 60 days to 12 months. So it will effectively extend postpartum coverage for eligible women from 60 days to 12 months. That is a 10-month extension.
Great, thank you. Do we have any questions for Deputy Commissioner Ritchie? And if not, then we'll go to one amendment that we have. I don't see any questions. So with that, we do have an amendment from Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move amendment number one, which is work order 33-GS158.3/A.1.
Okay, and we'll take a moment to let folks find that amendment, which I'm not sure. Oh, here we go. Does anybody not have that amendment? Looks like everyone does. So with that, I will object for purposes of discussion. Representative Stapp, would you like to explain your amendments?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So the purpose of my amendment is effectively it looks to increase the eligibility of postpartum coverage for women who are pregnant from 200% of FPL, adjusted for the state of Alaska, to 225% of the federal poverty line. So what does that effectively mean? That means that there are a certain population of folks in our state that are kind of in between income requirements regarding, they don't quite make enough money to be able to afford health insurance, but during the expansion of this postpartum coverage, they may fall into a category in which they don't actually have any health insurance coverage. And it's my goal to kind of echo what the students of the executive said, is kind of try to make Alaska one of the most pro-family states in the union. And I think the best way to do that is to ensure that certain segments of our populations throughout the state that are right there on that income threshold are not afforded this opportunity to get the quality health care that they deserve, because they effectively made $3 more an hour. So my amendment would look to cover more of those women so they can take advantage of this opportunity to get quality health care.
Thank you very much, Representative Stapp. Do you know what the impact to the fiscal note would be?
Yes, through the chair, so far the fiscal note that I have been informed of would add an additional $1.5 million to the fiscal note of the bill. I'm going to look to cover upwards of 450 more women.
Okay. And I see the Fed portion is $6.4 million and the state portion is $2.6 million. So is that number that you quoted, I think it was 1.6 or 1.4, is that all state, all fed, or is that split?
Yeah, through the chair to co-chair Foster, that is the state GF. Of course, that leverages a bunch of federal money through the Medicaid program. The FMAP for this type of category, the federal matching percentage, is 70% funded by the federal government and 30% funded by the state.
Great, thank you. We've got a few questions. I saw a couple hands go up. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I'd like to speak to this amendment. I, Chair Foster, I'm fully supportive of this amendment. I don't think we can do enough for, given our current data with regard to our children, our youngest, and our pregnant moms, and the rates of issues that we have downstream, so to speak. And I guess my question for the maker of the amendment is if we have done some assessment around the costs. I wonder also if we've done any assessment on the savings, given what we know when we have upstream health care, that the downstream health care, then those costs are fewer. And perhaps Dr. Zink can answer that as well. Thank you very much.
Dr. Zink, thank you for joining us. I understand you're down in meeting with the Senate, so thanks for rushing up. And it sounds like there might have been a question there, if you'd like to reply. And if you could also put yourself on the record.
Yes. For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska. I do apologize. I was presenting downstairs for Senate. So, Chair Foster, through the Chair, Representative Galvin. I'll speak a little bit about savings, and then I'll let Desi Ricci talk a little bit about cost. Savings, in looking at this postpartum bill and looking at savings, can be hard to calculate. However, we have submitted previous data and happy to provide more. That particularly in that first year of life is when you're going to have the best return on investment for both kids as well as that mom. So what happens for their adverse childhood experiences, being able to support mom's mental health and physical health helps to support her. So there's evidence that 26% more children will get their first well child checks if their mom has access to health insurance. So even if the child has access to health insurance, mom is more likely to get access to bring that child in if they're able to do it. There's evidence on dental care. There's evidence on immunizations. And again, kind of really being able to move upstream along those lines. The national CBO did look at this, kind of long-term savings, and felt as though this was such a big, important measure to be able to move forward as a country, that that's why they made this as an option, as I'm sure DC Ritchie went through forward. But how do we calculate for that? Alaska is really challenging, and why we don't really calculate it in our fiscal note, and why we specifically look at the cost. We're just looking at people utilizing care. What sort of care are they going to need? So for that specific component about this amendment and that additional number of people, we're getting to a really small number of people to say what the care is. And so that's why I'm speaking very much in generalities about why prevention helps. But the way we calculate our fiscal note is just really looking at the number of people we estimated in that specific group who would access care in that year. DC Ricci?
For the record, Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health, and kind of speaking specifically to the proposed amendment, we have calculated, an initial cost. I want to say this is still being vetted, but initially what we did is we looked at how many women would be are between the ages of 15 and 45 in the state of Alaska, and based on the community population survey, how many of those we believe their income is between 200 and 220% of the federal poverty level. And there's about 7,000 women based on that information. So then we applied the birth rate currently per 1,000, and that is 64.3 births per 1,000, and that results in an estimated 450 births per year in this population. So then we looked at the same number that we were using in calculating the fiscal note for specific to postpartum extensions. We use that 566 per mother per month number and apply that to the 450 births per year that this amendment would cover at a high level, and then looked at that coverage over 21 months, so assuming 9 months of pregnancy and then 12 months of coverage following postpartum. And so with that, again, our estimated cost right now, and this is still being dialed in and will be dialed in more closely through a fiscal note, is around $5.3 million, and about 28% of that would be the state's share, and that estimate is about $1.5 million in UGF.
Follow up?
Thank you. I appreciate both of your responses to that. I think it's really helpful for us to understand the full picture as we're making these important amendments, thinking about how we can expand and better what we're offering, particularly in light that we can't get this put in place for over a year, and that's a whole other line of questioning for later. But I want to appreciate that when we have this opportunity for even 450 more to have an upstream care, I think about less emergency care. I think about early identification of learning issues and how important that is with regard to our system as we are downstream looking at remedial work with within education, and how all of these costs really, I think, have been on a national level considered, and I think there may be some numbers out there for national savings, if you will, with regard to putting in this investment early. But I look forward to hearing how this program goes and how we can maybe come up with some local Alaska level numbers, because to me, I can't think of anything more important in terms of an investment. So thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. I know I've got Representative Ortiz in the queue. I feel like there might have been somebody. Did you have your hand up before? I think, okay, that's what it was. Representative Hannon and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair Foster. And I was going to ask this of the maker of the amendment, but then I heard the department reference it. So my question has to do with, and I'm just trying to understand, the maker of the motion referenced moving it from 200% of federal poverty to 225, but the brackets where it references say 175. And so I'm just trying to understand, because both the maker of the motion and the department have said 200%. So I presume that's current statute, but.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Hannon, I'll defer to the department on this too. Our effective statutes regarding a lot of these Medicaid rates are not accurate, right? So I brought that up in a previous meeting regarding this. Since Medicaid expansion passed and the previous governor, CMS required us to cover people at higher levels of poverty line, and our statutes, most of them just don't reflect that change. Okay. So, and I just defer to the department too, if they want to comment.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, this is Emily Ricci for the record. In 2014, there were kind of nationwide changes in the Medicaid program, and the way that federal poverty, that income levels were calculated, essentially transitioned to something called Modified Adjusted Gross Income, or MAGI. And as a result of that change, kind of the effective impact of that, states were required to adopt that change for certain Medicaid categories, resulted in an effective 200% rate of the federal poverty level. So that's really reflective of that change to what you may hear referred to as kind of MAGI standards that took effect in 2014.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would say, in the spirit of the MAGI, we want to deliver these babies safely. And talking about this, it's a much smaller percentage increase versus if you just look at the statute. And I am supportive of the amendment and the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Ms. Ritchie already answered my question. It was around how we arrived at the 450 figure, and you did that quite well, so thank you. I have no further questions.
Representative Colomb and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chair. Just a comment. Just wanted to say thank you to Representative Staff for putting forward the amendment. I just appreciate his detailed work, make sure that we're covering as many as we can on the bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I think for Ms. Ritchie, you said you're still vetting and finalizing the number, but it's going to be in a range, right? It's going to be in that $1.3 million, $1.5 million range, plus or minus a little bit.
Ms. Ritchie.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is what we believe right now based on the numbers that we've looked at. Again, we're working with divisions to make sure that we've thought about any additional unintended costs that we may not be aware of. We're actively as well discussing with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services to make sure that we understand what changes they may require if we implement this change, and then to understand any sort of costs that could accrue from that. But we do anticipate it would be within this range. So again, $5.3 million total cost and about $1.5 UGF.
Follow up?
There's nothing, through the chair, Ms. Ritchie, there's nothing that you know of concerning Title 42 of the United States Code or CMS that would prohibit going to this rate?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, no. There's nothing that would prohibit that I'm aware of. There's several other states that have implemented rates at the same level or higher. It's really a matter of what the process is. Again, because this is a joint federal-state program, making sure that our federal partners, that we clearly understand the process that they require us to use to make these changes.
If I may, for the record, Ann Zink, Representative Joseph, through the chair, just like to continue to emphasize that these estimates, these numbers that we do, are looking at previous services that a mother needs and uses. It doesn't mean that's how much will be spent or has to be spent, and there's a lot of work happening within the Department of Health to decrease the need to be able to move upstream to create preventative services outside of that, so that may not even come up to that number, but that's just how we have to calculate that. So these are just expected medical expenditures based on previous expenditures. Thank you.
Thank you. So with that, I will remove my objection to Amendment Number 1. Are there any other objections to Amendment Number 1? Seeing no objections, Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. Is there anything else before I entertain a motion? Any questions, comments, Representative Edgman? I'm sorry, I think that might be an entertaining, so let me go to a entertaining a motion. But before that, any questions or comments? I see none. Thank you very much, Representative Co-Chair Edgman.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 58, version 33-GS1583/A, as amended from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes forthcoming.
Okay, and I see no objections. So with that, Senate Bill 58, version 33-GS1583/A is amended, is reported out from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes. And so with that, if we can maybe go ahead and pass out the paper and have everyone sign the recommendation. So next up, we have House Bill 28, and that's access to marijuana. Thank you very much, Ms. Ritchie and Dr. Zink. And before us is House Bill 28, access to marijuana conviction records. And so with that, I'd like to ask Representative Wright and his staff, Mr. Reardon Randall, to come to the table. And we've also got invited testimony from the Reason Foundation, and also Lacey Wilcox from the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. So with that, Representative Wright, if you can put yourself on the record and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I am Representative Stanley Wright from House District 22. I'm very excited to be here today, and I'd like to thank you for hearing HB 28. I want to talk about hope. I want to talk about why this bill is important. This bill gives folks the hope that they need to move on with their lives. And there's two reasons why. There's two parts to the bill, so I'll just get into it. The first part would be removing the names from the Court View website. It's not accessible anymore to anyone, and it will stop the opportunity for individuals to lose their candidacy to get a job from a simple Court View search. It will give folks an opportunity to rent an apartment and not get a call back saying that it was already rented. That's why this bill is important. Number two is the DPS database. It also will not seal, but getting the word that I wanted to say, it would limit accessibility to the records. So HB 28 creates hope for the individuals that are out there trying to move on with their lives. They're trying to start over. They paid their debt to society, and now this is their opportunity to move forward. And now with that, I will pass this over to my legislative staffer, Mr. Pi Reardon Randall, for further details.
Mr. Reardon Randall, please put yourself on the record.
To the chair, for the record, my name is Pi Reardon Randall, legislative aide to Representative Stanley Wright of House District 22. I'd like to thank the chairs and members of the committee for holding this hearing today for us for House Bill 28. House Bill 28 recognizes there are still convictions on the books, which by today's statutes wouldn't exist. These convictions can be burdensome on individuals, as when they're found in reports or online, they can be deceiving in the way they look to the untrained eye, which, as the representative spoke to, can cause adverse action for these individuals. The bill does contain provisions for certain organizations and agencies to access the records in whole or in part in the listed circumstances under the bill. I appreciate the time. I would like to read from the sectional for breakdown on the bill.
Please continue.
Section 1, it is the intention of the legislation to reduce barriers to employment and other basic daily functions for individuals who, under past statute, were convicted of low-level marijuana-related crimes. Section 2 describes when, why, and to what agencies or organizations information protected in this bill may be released. Section 3, persons aged 21 years or older at the time of the offense shall, in the provisions of this bill, have records of low-level marijuana convictions as detailed in this section, which by today's statutes are not considered a criminal act, made inaccessible other than as less listed in Section 2. Individuals having this action taken shall pay a fee of not less than $150, and that was part of the committee substitute from Judiciary. Section 4, records relating to the individuals and occurrences in this bill shall not be publicly published by the Alaska court system. Information shall be made available on how to obtain information removed from public view. Section 5, an effective date for this act shall be the 1st of January, 2024.
Okay. Anything else before we move to invited testimony?
I would move to invited testimony.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So with that, we have two folks, one in the room and one in Florida. With the Reason Foundation, we have Vittorio Natazzi. Vittorio, if you can put yourself on the record and proceed with your invited testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Vittorio Nastassi, and I'm the Director of Criminal Justice Policy at Reason Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. The academic research is clear. People with criminal records face significant difficulty engaging in productive activities such as finding a job and securing housing. House Bill 28 would help address these barriers for Alaskans who have low-level marijuana possession convictions. People who have been convicted of for a behavior that is no longer considered criminal in Alaska. The bill would not result in the expungement of any criminal records. In other words, the records won't be erased. They will still be available to some extent. The legislation simply places limitations on the release of these records if eligible individuals formally request that the records be withheld. The additional requirement of a $150 fee for this privilege will likely reduce the positive impact of the bill. Research suggests that requiring petitions and the payment of fees greatly reduces the efficacy of policies aimed at sealing or expunging criminal records. A recent study published in Harvard Law Review found that only 6.5% of those who were eligible under Michigan's expungement program pursued expungement when they were required to apply and pay fees. Similarly low participation rates have been observed in other states where release is not automatic. It's for this reason that a growing number of states have established automatic record release programs. Given the experiences of other states, it is likely that only a small fraction of eligible Alaskans will be aware that their records may be withheld and will actually request that they not be released. Consequently, the fiscal note on this bill likely overstates the administrative burden that DPS will incur. Moreover, requiring a $150 fee creates an additional barrier to low-income individuals who stand to benefit the most from record release. The fee will also likely fail to raise substantial revenues. Despite being a relatively small step compared to the actions of other states, House Bill 28 would provide much-needed relief to those who make the effort to request that their records be withheld. However, the requirement of a $150 fee, or I should really say a minimum $150 fee, is an unnecessary complication to an otherwise good bill. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Natasi. Do we have any questions from the committee? We've got one, Representative Galvin.
Thank you so much, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair, thank you very much for putting this forward. I think it's important that we have more of our citizens who have already paid their time, so to speak. Not that all of them have paid time, but certainly they have been through the process, need to find their way toward becoming whole. And this seems to be an important step there. I do have a question with regard to the fee that has been added. I wondered a couple of things. One is, why was it put in place? Is it truly to cover costs? And if so, I wondered if there have been considerations around savings if we have this particular opportunity in place to take away our the challenges that we know these folks are experiencing in getting jobs, housing, and healthcare. If they are able to have easier access to these three, which seem to be very important in my mind, in terms of the state not having to pay for these people if they can't get access to a job, for example, the unemployment costs and other things, to me, would far outweigh our ability to collect a few dollars to help potentially pay for administrative costs, which sounds like, from what I've just heard from the expert, wouldn't be very high. So I just wondered if you could help me with that particular conversation, and I would like to know if kind of what that was like and why we led to that number.
Mr. Reardon Randall?
And through the chair, the purpose of the fee was to offset the cost to the state. I know that there was some research done by DPS, and we do have Lisa Purrington, who can speak to what she found on there, as they are the ones that provided the fiscal note.
Representative Galvin?
Thank you, through the chair. If we can get some more understanding about that fiscal note, and more importantly, if that particular person also considered the savings to the state, like I said, with regard to long-term savings, if we're not paying unemployment, we're not paying housing, and we're not paying health care when folks are duly employed.
Mr. Reardon Randall, did you refer to Lisa Purrington?
That is correct.
Okay, it looks like Lisa's not online, but maybe we'll make sure they're... Oh, she's in the room. Okay.
And
Mr. Reverend Randall?
To the chair, through the chair. For clarification, the fee was added in the committee substitute in judiciary, and I know that they did their own research on why and how they wanted to add that, and part of it was related to the fiscal cost.
Ms. Purinton, would you mind coming up and answering, if you can put yourself on the record?
For the record, Lisa Purinton, Criminal Records and Identification Bureau Chief for the Department of Public Safety. Through the chair to Representative Galvin's question, as the bill sponsors team reported, the fee was added in House Judiciary as their policy decision to make the amendment for the current bill before us. The original bill, the department did have a fiscal note that was attached to the cost to change the programming in the state's criminal history repository. The Department of Public Safety maintains the official state criminal history record, and we are the repository where individuals will come to for background checks for their official record. And it's a separate database than what is on the court system through their CourtView application. The state's criminal history repository is a mainframe database. I'm sure you've heard that term quite a bit for this session from the 80s. And the programming cost to make that change was going to be part of that fiscal note. And we also anticipated part-time temporary incremental funding for a position for 2 years because we anticipated the bulk of these requests would come in the first 2 years. And so we needed additional staffing to handle the influx of individuals that would come in to have the their records, to have that particular conviction being restricted from access for certain background check processes. And so with that, we estimated that there was roughly 8,500 records that could potentially fall under the criteria under HB 28 for the limited marijuana convictions because the state's repository goes back to statehood for those convictions. And so it's the database doesn't always have a straight statute to indicate the definition for the conviction. Sometimes it had just a four-digit code and would just say it was a marijuana conviction. So trying to determine if that conviction actually had less than an ounce. The statutes haven't always indicated that it was going to be less than an ounce. Sometimes it was up to 8 ounces. So with that, that was going to be some research that we would have to do for when individuals would come in to petition to have that removed. And so we just didn't have the resources to assign staff to do the research for potentially 8,000 records. Or 8,500 records. So that's where the fiscal note came in, and then the House Judiciary decided to help offset those costs by adding the fee in there, and that's where we anticipated that we didn't project out more than 2 years because it's a very much an unknown because we don't know the volume of individuals that would come in. So that's where we were estimating out how those costs for program receipts would offset the cost for the department to actually do the work to make this happen.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. One final follow-up. Two things come to mind. One is I think I heard in there that somehow the way we're collecting data makes it more complicated and is going to need some extra research time. I'm assuming that going forward this bill looks at making sure we collect that differently so it doesn't require the extra research, but more importantly, what I wondered is, as the Judiciary Committee asked you for this extra research on the costs of implementation, if they considered in their analysis, again, the savings that would be to the state, should we get even one person an opportunity for a job, housing, healthcare, mental health care, because they've been able to find their way back as a whole person who is working. So I just wanted to ask that again, if that was part of the analysis and consideration. Thank you, Chair Foster.
Through the Ms. chair, Hanson. Representative Galvin, I appreciate the question. With the Department of Public Safety, the only thing that the department focused on were the costs to the department. And so we did not look at any broader impact to the state. We were just solely focused on the department's cost. And to answer your question about the difficulties in identifying the particulars on the statute, the way this bill is worded, it is very specific to AS 1171-060 for subsection A1 or A1A. And with that, it didn't always, some of the conviction information, the court judgments we received, don't always have that level of granularity added. Sometimes the subsections weren't added. So currently, we're good on that. We've been working really closely with the Department of Law and with the Alaska court system to make sure we're unified and how we're using all of those specifics of the subsections. But unfortunately, if looking back historically, that wasn't always the case. And so it's the historical records that are more challenging. Thank you.
So our hard stop is in 2 minutes, I was hoping to get through the invited testimony. The questions that we have from Representative Josephson, Hannon, and Colomb, were those for Mr. Natasi online? No? Okay. These are all for the sponsor. Let's maybe if we could save the questions for the sponsor and the department at our next meeting. We've got Ms. Lacey Wilcox here also for invited testimony, and so thank you very much, Ms. Pierrington. Maybe if we can have you come up and give your invited testimony, and if we have any questions for you, and then we'll go ahead and close it out for the day, and we'll bring the bill back before us. If you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Lacey Wilcox, Legislative Liaison for the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association, which sounds like a trade group because that's what it is. But before we were a trade group, we were a bunch of activists for legalization through the ballot measure process. I appreciate Representative Galvin's comment about taking into account the cost that we've already incurred for a 6A possession, a simple possession of marijuana. So for history, Alaska's had a pretty strange relationship with legalization. I think from 1975 to 1990, we were decriminalized. So if you were in that window, you might not have received any citation of any kind. I think we recriminalized in 1990 to 1998 pretty severely through the war on drugs. We were assessing a $100 fine for simple citation or up to 90 days in jail. So we have paid the price already. And if we're talking about $150 to make the state whole, I believe the state has made money on the back of a cycle of legalization, decriminalization, simple possession citation, and 90 days in jail. So I support the bill and the policy therein, but I would really respect a look again at the charging of the fee for people who reasonably have already paid their debt.
Great.
Thank you
very much, Ms. Wilcox. Do we have any questions? I don't see any questions. Thanks for joining us today. So with that, we are going to be coming back tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, April 27th. We do have 6 bills before us, so it is that time of year where things are going to be picking up. 3 of the bills that we've already heard and 3 are new. And so those bills are first, I think we'll be able to hopefully move, we'll take public testimony and then move HB 26, which is Council for Alaska Native Languages. Then we'll take up SB 87, which is Lumber Grading Program, and that's the companion bill to HB 93, which we've heard before this committee. And then hopefully we'll be able to move that if it is well of the committee. And then we'll also be setting an amendment deadline for SB 87, the lumber grading program bill for tomorrow, April 27th at noon. So that's not too long before finance. And any amendments, if you could please drop those off or email them to my staff, Brody Anderson. And then 3 other bills that will be before us, HB 125, that's the trapping cabins on state lands. SB 25, which is repealing funds, accounts, and programs, and finally HB 178, which is village safe water facilities. And those will be heard for the first time. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:01 p.m. Thank you.